it's envy, and it's like, even when people are super successful, they find something to be jealous about. Like, oh, you know, I won an Emmy, but that person won an Oscar. Or, oh, I did this movie, but that other one was more successful and more people listened to the soundtrack album, or blah, blah, blah. There's always something.
Oh my god, congratulations.
Well, thank you. We should release this one like months from now, so that the context makes no sense.
Yeah, nope. Congrats. For the people who doesn't know that, I don't think, because I've been spamming all around
it's
my social
media.
It's
been very sweet and very, it's very nice of you, and I appreciate the support. It's really, really kind.
Yeah, it's very exciting. As I mentioned before, I'm not a big fan of competitions or awards in general, because whatever, you know, I am just a consumer. If I like the content, that's great, and that's it. I used to watch the Oscars, but not anymore. Like, that was fun as a show.
Yeah, you and everybody else, the ratings for the Oscars just every year continue to go down and down and down.
Yeah. But no, I'm so happy for you. I guess you're getting used to this.
No, it's never like that. It's we didn't actually say what it is, but the Grammys added
they don't follow me on social media. They're missing.
Well, I guess that's true, but it's worth adding some history that this is the first time there's ever been a category for video game music at the Grammys, which was something that was organized by some people. I was actually not involved in the process by which that happened, despite having a prior nomination. But I knew it was going on. I knew that there were people from some of the big game companies and publishers and people like that who were basically lobbying the Recording Academy to add a video game specific category.
Oh, so this was like under a petition.
Yeah, I mean, there's always people every year that are trying to make improvements and changes to the Grammys, you know, like combining categories or splitting apart categories. For example, this year they added 5 new categories, one of which was Songwriter of the Year, which I thought was actually a really great idea, because there's a lot of songwriters that work with multiple pop stars. You know, it'll mm-hmm. be like, oh, I wrote a song for Beyonce, and I wrote a song for Adele, and I wrote a song for so-and-so. And now there's a category for those people that are like the secret behind the famous performer.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So
what was supposed to be the one that they joined? Like, they didn't have any?
There was no recognition. It was like Song of the Year, where they might get nominated as like the writer of that song, sharing it with the artist performing it,
right,
if it's a different person. But if you're somebody who wrote like 5 top hits, you're a top songwriter of the year. Maybe none of those songs got nominated, but it's like you had a big influence on the industry. So therefore you are a top songwriter of the year. That's the thinking behind it. They have that category for producer. They have 2 different producer of the year categories. They have a classical producer of the year and a non-classical producer of the year. So someone like Ludwig Göransson, who, you know, might work with, like, Ludwig worked on all the various artists who did songs in the new Black Panther. But, you know, Adele released a new album a few months ago that he also was a co-producer on. And like, he does that a lot. He worked Childish Gambino. He worked with Justin Timberlake on the Trolls movie, for example. He didn't score that movie, but he produced the songs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's like the idea of non-classical producer of the year, Ludwig would be an automatic candidate for that every year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He wasn't nominated as far as I'm aware.
That's
but
cool. I didn't know that I didn't know that they were open to make changes.
Oh,
that
absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely.
Cool. And this is the first time that somebody pitches the video game, or is that like a fight that's been going for a while?
There's a lot of history there. 1999 was when a group of composers managed to successfully solicit the Recording Academy to make video game releases eligible for the soundtrack category. And so in 1999, they changed it to best score soundtrack album for film, TV, or other visual media. And they kept that name for 10 years, but not one video game was ever nominated until 2012, when Journey was nominated. That was the first and only time that that happened. Mm-hmm. And to date, that's still the only one ever that was nominated under that category.
Mm-hmm.
Because then another 10 years passed since Journey's nomination. Right. And they finally said, rather than... Because at some point they changed the name to just Score Soundtrack for Visual Media so that they could combine film, TV, and it all was like one concept. And but still no games were ever getting nominated. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. People were like, oh, it's unfair to video games or whatever. And I was like, well, the problem is there's no game industry people in the Recording Academy. It's a bunch of film and TV mm-hmm. people, so they don't know about yeah. games. So what do you expect is going to happen? So my attitude was always, game industry people should join the Recording Academy, like me, like Chris Tin, like right. a few others who've mm-hmm. been there for ages. Mm-hmm. And we're always like casting votes, and no one, like I voted for Darren Korb for Pyre a few years ago. But anyway, they finally said, all right, how about we make our own? Because, you know, it's true that writing a video game score is very different from writing a film and TV score. I don't think that the Grammys should care about that, but I was like, so be it.
Yeah.
They created a new category, which meant Journey would no longer be the only nominee, and every year there'd be five new ones.
One of the first nominees, again, double first.
Yeah, I was very lucky that Aliens Fireteam, the soundtrack album was put out so much later than the original release of the game. That's the only reason it was eligible this time.
Right. That was lucky.
Because like I saw People Bear, for example, was nominated for Call of Duty. And I saw, of course, on Twitter, people going, what the fuck? He wasn't nominated for God of War. The Grammys are stupid. And I'm like, you guys, he'll be eligible for next year's Grammy for God of War. Like, God of War came out after the window for right. this Grammy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think that God of War came out like 3 days ago. You think the Grammys...
Yeah.
Could possibly vote on a thing that had been out for like 48 hours. Only, yep. like, that's ridiculous. Yep. But they have no idea.
How does that work for the Game Awards?
Fuck if I know. I don't even, to this day, I've never figured out who even votes on the Game Awards. I've never been asked to. I've never met anybody that votes on the Game Awards. I haven't the faintest clue how those nominees.
Wow.
As far as I know, it's Jeff Keighley personally choosing the games he likes. I know it's not actually that. I know there is an attempt to make it a kind of fair process, but I genuinely, because like the BAFTAs are decided by committee, the DICE Awards are decided by committee, the Gang Awards are decided by a combination of committee and the voting membership of the Game Audio Network Guild. The Oscars are chosen by members of the Motion Picture Academy. The Emmys are chosen by members of the Television Academy, et cetera, et cetera.
How the hell you know all this information for like, and then there's like so little info about the industry you work on.
The industry, I know a lot about the industry. It's just the Game Awards.
The awards of video games. Like you should know.
I know
more.
About every single one of them except Jeff Keighley's show.
Yeah, what the fuck?
It's because it's his private. Operation. It's not like it's a he created it from scratch himself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I on the one hand I admire that he created a thing from nothing. I mean, he really like talked to Troy about it. Troy is always like Keighley put like millions of dollars on the line. He put his whole life on at stake. If the Game Awards had been a failure, he'd be like homeless. Mm-hmm. So I respect that. But it's his show the way he wants to do it. My biggest gripe with the Game Awards isn't even the transparency on how the awards are chosen. That's something I've always been unclear on. But for all I know, there's some website that details it now, and I just haven't looked in several years.
I see.
It's not like I care, but I...
Right.
So I haven't ever actually Googled it. My biggest thing is I don't really like... the intermingling of selling slots to show trailers with an award show. I'm
right.
not a big fan of the format. The Game Awards are part E3 and part award show.
Yeah.
And it always feels like it's a thing called the Game Awards that is actually meant to make you more excited about the reveals of new games. And like, that's the business model. And the thing is, here's at the end of the day, I can criticize it or I can say I think it's silly, but Jeff has built a thing that like 90 million people watch. So
true.
Obviously he has found a thing people like. and companies are willing to pay unbelievable amounts of money to be part of, and it's a big deal. Anytime I'm working on a game and they go, hey, we think we're going to end up having a trailer at the Game Awards, everybody knows this is like our big reveal. This is a big deal. Tens of millions of people are going to find out about our game in one moment. Like, so props to him. He built a thing that's massive, and no other award show does that. They don't build the Oscars around Marvel has never done, hey, guess what the new Phase 6 movies are going to be, by revealing it at the Oscars. They don't do that. Now, there's always been this idea that no, these are about last year's things, not what's coming. But clearly the market says, hey, it's pretty cool to see new trailers and a lot of. So, you know, who am I to judge?
Yeah. Okay. That's good that you can make your peace.
Yeah, it's one of those where it's not the kind of show that I would make, but I would probably make a show less successful than his. I can acknowledge that.
Who knows? Don't say that. Who knows? We'll see.
Well, but no, he's overwhelmingly
I assume you're just, you're just more, you like to celebrate the games. You're an artist.
And the artist behind them.
He is a business guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I can see the difference.
Half the categories at the Game Awards aren't even part of the show. Like no composer has ever received an award and stood on stage and said, I want to thank my parents and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Like, they don't include music in the show. They put like bands, like Imagine Dragons will come and do a medley of Arcane mixed with Darren doing Bastion, which is like a cool moment and, you know, whatever. But I mean, I actually loved that. I was biased. I worked on it with Darren. I helped. But like, that's like a musical performance that's like 4.5 minutes long. But they can't spare 30 seconds for a nominee to go up and say, I thank you for this award. Whereas like as a kid watching the Oscars, when they go, here's the award for, best editing. And I go, what's editing? And then some guy I've never heard of, you know, Michael Caine goes up on stage for a Spielberg film and they're like, this is his fifth nomination. I go, whoa, really? Like, you know, and I felt like you learned about the art and people had reverence, you know, best costume design. Person goes up, you know, the woman who won the Oscar for Black Panther, for example, for best costuming, and whole crowd of 3,000 people cheering for this person you've never even heard of as a normal viewer. Like, it evangelized that it wasn't, film is not just Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt and the movie stars, and like it is a thousand artists behind the scenes as well. Mm-hmm. And how, like, I'll never forget in the year 2000 when the Oscar nominated scores, Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak Perlman did a medley of the five nominated scores.
Ah, nice.
With the backing orchestra, and on screen they were showing like behind the scenes footage that went into the making of each of those five scores. And I remember thinking, it's possible I'm conflating two different Oscar years, but I remember they did that once where you saw like footage of the scoring sessions while you're hearing, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or whatever. Mm-hmm, and it was like, imagine being a person who never thought about best score before, but never thought about film scores before, watching glimpses of the process while these artists pay homage, you know? And obviously the idea of like, now they always do the clip, the montage, here's the noteworthy people in the business that died this year. And there's a certain reverence of love of like, our community lost meaningful people. It always just felt like it's a big love letter to film. And the Emmys were a love letter to television, and the Tonys are a big love letter to theater.
Broadway. I get it. I understand how the commercial aspect of it takes away time for celebrating people behind the games. But
The Grammys were always pretty good about that. Going to the Grammys back when Journey was nominated, and watching the show in person was quite impressive, because the way they had the stage set up was it was two stages in one, and the way it would work is the cameras, because they would have, you know, like, and now Taylor Swift is going to perform, and there's like 50 dancers and she's on stage and there's lighting effects and like moving walkways, and it's like a really elaborate production. What was so, what you couldn't see, what the people watching on TV couldn't see, was that like 5 inches away, right off camera, they were preparing for the next performer. So the, so there was like crew, stage crew, like building a set, like instant, like super fast, and materials coming down from the ceiling, like robot arms lowering like the new thing into position so that her thing ends, the audience is cheering and screaming or whatever. And but like right over there, it, you know, they were going to come back to commercial and then just be like, and now ladies and gentlemen, welcome Adele. And it's like a whole new set, it's a completely different set, and you're like, how do they do this? And it's like, oh, because they're side by side and the cameras are just making it so you never see what's going on over there.
Right.
And
right.
I remember thinking the complexity of pulling this thing off is beyond my comprehension. It was so impressive as a piece of stagecraft, like for television viewing. So cool to be able to witness that in person.
Talking about stage, do you see what they did for the new Encanto at the Hollywood Bowl?
I've only seen photos. It seemed quite elaborate.
I just saw like 4 pictures from Anthony.
Right. Yeah, same.
Which is like so cool. Like his first time. Seems like.
Very happy for him.
Conducting the bowl. So yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I know he spent many years. Anthony Parnther is his full name for any listeners. He spent many years primarily earning his living as a bassoon player, and he still very much plays bassoon constantly. He's one of the top bassoonists in L.A., which by default...
He's been in, like, all the movies.
He's played on everything, yeah. He's one of the best bassoon players probably in the world, because to be at the top of the list for L.A. calls means you're going to have to be one of the best players of that instrument around, you know? So he's one of a handful... London and a few other places where, you know, they really could stack up as the best of the best. But he's also this very gifted conductor, and he's done a lot of concerts, and he has his own, like the Southeast Symphony and the San Bernardino Symphony. And so he's been making his way as a conductor for a number of years. But the last, I don't know, 2-3 years, maybe a little more, but really recently, it's like the match fell on the fire, and his conducting demands are so extreme that he seemingly practically can't play bassoon anymore. I know he does, but it's astonishing that so many people have made him their chief conductor. You know, Pinar Toprak uses him. Ludwig Göransson.
Can
uses
you just
him.
Name some of the titles just so they know what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, he conducted the new Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. You know, he was in London for like a month, recording at Abbey Road. He conducts all the League of Legends recording sessions for Eduardo Brennison and a bunch of others. He conducts, like I said, for Pinar. She had a movie come out called Lost City with Sandra Bullock that I know he conducted the sessions for. He conducts for, let me think, who else? I mean, the list is so enormous.
Yeah, he's been like in Star Wars and a lot of Marvel stuff and.
He did Mandalorian and he did all because he does all of Ludwig's, and he did also he also did Joe Shirley's for Boba Fett
and
the new Creed as well, and he's, you know, plus he conducts orchestras all the time. He recently did a show, you know, he did Disney Hall not that long ago, conducting the Chris Bowers concert of music, like from Bridgerton and King Richard and all these other things, and a new horn concerto. He did Carnegie Hall, John Batiste, Stephen Colbert's music director, who also was one of the Oscar-winning trio on Soul with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. The incredible jazz musician, John Batiste. He did a show at Carnegie Hall that Anthony made his Carnegie Hall conducting debut, which is a very big deal. And now he's had his Hollywood Bowl conducting Encanto live to picture. He's done a lot of those live to picture shows as well. As a side note, he did recently, I think, Empire Strikes Back with like the Philadelphia Symphony or something, or Cleveland, or I can't remember. I can't keep up, honestly.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And
it's crazy.
He's so talented too. I was able to visit him when I was in London for the Proms show. He was there at Abbey Road conducting a score of a friend of mine, John Everest, for a game. And so I snuck over there. He didn't know I was coming, and I snuck into the booth. They were in Studio One, the big giant scoring stage at Abbey Road. And And it was time to take a break. So I said, do you mind if I call the break? And so the engineer slid over and I said, Maestro, I think that's a good place to stop for now. Why don't we take 15? And I saw him. He goes, do I hear Austin Wintory in the booth? It was so funny. He goes,
I was very dramatic. Of him.
He goes, I think my credit score just went down.
Oh, my God.
Dude, that was so funny.
Yeah, I know. I think you told this story on this show before. I'm pretty sure.
But maybe. But yeah, it was.
His voice is so low and intimidating.
Oh, yeah. He's done voiceover work occasionally. He gets hired.
Yes, you're right.
He's got a very good, very baritone. And he's very sarcastic. And he's just so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, he sings too, yeah. Anyway, he's a perfect example of somebody who I know... to the outside world, he always seems successful, but he's very ambitious and he's very talented. And so, like so many creative people, he felt constantly frustrated by the idea of why hasn't my opportunity come yet? And to everybody else, it was like, first off, you're doing pretty great, man. But also, it's just a matter of time before even bigger doors will open for you because your talent is so undeniable. And so it's been very vindicating to see that absolutely come true. Right. That, like, yes, he was always conducting, but there's a difference between, you know, having jobs and Carnegie Hall and the Hollywood Bowl.
Right.
And it always felt inevitable because the reason I brought up the Abbey Road when I was there is I was watching his podium manner and he really is very good. He's so confident. And obviously the fact that he's such a gifted bassoonist means that he knows exactly what to tell the musicians that's enough to be useful to them. He doesn't just blabber on about things that don't matter that make them go, yeah, but like...
Yeah, exactly. He's being on the other side, so he knows exactly what they need.
He knows exactly what they need, how to help them, how to stay out of their way and let them be their best. And it was really inspiring because I'm definitely guilty of, as I'm doing right now, I can go on for too long, and I always.
It's okay because this is getting to a good point. Actually, that we haven't mentioned
our topic of today.
The topic of today is other success, and how we see it, and how we react to that. And I think you've been always very positive about, you know, the wins of other people, even if they're not friends. You're always being so, like, you actively share that out there in social media, or I don't know. I've noticed that ever since I met you, that you are very,
like, supportive or
yes.
Yeah. Well, I won't say who, I won't name names, but years ago I was in charge of planning an event and there was a very well-known composer who was involved. And we were planning with like his agent and manager and a few other people. And we were at his house and there was like a friend or somebody, I don't remember who was there, but there was somebody there that is not part of the industry of like Hollywood or whatever. And they asked this composer, they said, because we were saying, oh, you know, what if we got, you know, John Williams to come, or we got, whatever, we're naming a few, like, wouldn't it be cool if we could get some really, like, really big names involved? And this person themselves is a very big name as well. And the person said, wow, do all you composers all, like, know each other and are friends? And this guy goes, honestly, we probably really just, realistically, we all hate each other. And I remember, and it made me think back to, like, the number of times that I've been around composers who speak very badly about their kind of like what they think of as their rivals. Like I remember once, again, I won't name any names because I'm not trying to besmirch people. I guess proof that I really am the opposite, that I don't want to make somebody look bad, but or betray any confidence of things that were said in private, of course. But I remember once I was talking to a composer who's very much an A-list composer, and they were talking about a different A-list composer. And so composer A says, composer B once told me that if I were James Horner and I had written My Heart Will Go On, I'd kill myself.
Oh, yeah, but that is like a known story.
That's not a known story.
Okay.
This was said in private.
Okay.
It was the two people... The composer A, who was talking about composer B, neither of those are publicly known.
Okay.
But of course, there's a lot of people that thought My Heart Will Go On is very cheesy. But to hear a colleague say that, to hear somebody who is a very respected, like true fellow A-list composer say that about James Horner, this was back when James Horner was still alive. They probably wouldn't say that now, but and these are not bad people, but there's a certain amount of like
envy.
It's envy, and it's like even when people are super successful, they find something to be jealous about. Like, oh, you know, I won an Emmy, but that person won an Oscar. Or, oh, I did this movie, but that other one was more successful and more people listened to the soundtrack album or blah, blah, blah. There's always something. And I've been around that, and I always thought, you know, first off, I got into this business because I was a fan. I fell in love with Jerry Goldsmith's music and John Williams and Danny Elfman and Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard and Alan Silvestri, Bernard Herrmann. These composers' music, I fell in love with so hard that I wanted to join their ranks. I wanted to try my hand at becoming part of that larger community. So it started from a place of love. The idea of, as soon as I show up, being like, you know, I'm better than them and they suck and what, like the number of young filmmakers that I've worked with who were so motivated by ego where they would go, you know, oh my God, did you see the latest Marvel? It's so and it's like, and then you see their shitty movie and you're like, those people, you know, you try to do what Michael Bay does. Like, I'm not a big Michael Bay. I'm not huge into the Transformers movies.
I was
going to
say, I probably will say the same, even though I'm not even involved in the industry. But yeah, I'm not excited about Marvel anymore.
No, but it's just as an example, the idea that people get involved because they think I'm the savior that's going to come on and fix it. And I'm going to show them how it's done. I'm like,
right.
Settle down. You know, like the people that love to shit on Spielberg, for example.
Actually, I think that is a better way to be than a lot of other people that just basically criticize others but don't do anything to be better.
That's a fair point. I would agree. It's one step up from like just sitting on your couch and saying it sucks. You know, put your money where your mouth is and try to do one better. But that said, I was just never that way. I was like, I really like, first off, I still love the art. I still enjoy, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to make a joke of like, what, your parents were happy or something? Like,
I was actually loved as a child.
Is there like a point in your life that you were like, okay, from now on, I'll be a good person. I'll support my peers. Or, you know, is there something that made you?
No, I think it's just that I kept doing what I did from the start. I discovered a thing I loved and then I decided to pursue it as a career. And I didn't suddenly stop loving it once I actually had a career. So if I still love it, why would I stop loving great music? You know, like Alan Silvestri wrote congrats on my Instagram post. Like, that blows my mind. Like, I didn't ever at some point
he
go,
did it today?
You know, oh, yeah,
that
it's on
so
there right
nice.
Now.
Oh my God.
And like, this is a childhood hero and someone who's still a hero. Like, this is someone who I still look forward to when I see he's got a new movie coming out, or like he did recently the Back to the Future musical where I was like, wow, imagine.
So cool.
Imagine if 30 years from now
it's
I did
Back
a Journey
to the Future
musical.
Guy, guys, just in case you don't know.
Back to the Future and Forrest Gump and Castaway. But now a whole new generation of kids know him as the guy that wrote Bum 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 Bum. Like, his staying power is really not that different from like John Williams. I mean, he burst onto the scene in 1984 with Back to the Future and Predator and movies like that. But he's the composer of Infinity War and Endgame and Captain America and the Avengers.
So cool.
And it's unbelievable.
And it's so contagious. Like, you see somebody else from the industry, like higher than you, doing that, like just supporting others. That's cool.
It's very kind. And I got a bunch of like, you know, composers, I guess I shouldn't say names, but some composers, including some very well-known ones, sent me very nice notes. So that's very nice. To answer your question, I think I've just always, it's just come from a place of enjoyment and love and positivity. It's the same way I write music. Every piece of music starts with this optimistic I'm going to sit down and try to write something that is worth putting in the world. I want to write a piece of music that's not just serving the game or the film or whatever I'm working on. It doesn't matter what, like, the pragmatic reason why I'm doing it. I still think I should try to put something that if someone ever hears this, even like whether it's on Spotify or because they're playing the game or watching the movie or whatever, it should add value to their life. Like that's an inherently positive, optimistic attitude.
It's a perfect example of love what you do, do what you love.
I hope so. Yeah, that's the aspiration. And because the other thing is, I don't operate under this belief that I'm I don't know why I should think I'm the best composer ever. You know, like why? But I feel like a lot of people, they start to get into that mindset where they become so inside their own head that it's like if they don't win an award or they're like, those idiots, don't they recognize my genius? Like I see that a lot.
That's another thing, because I think being so, focusing your energy on some like tangible object, I don't think that's the way to go.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. I remember once when I was in school, one of the teachers I sought out was this woman named Denise Hughes. And what caught my attention was the fact that she had studied under John Corigliano, who is a classical American composer who I think is one of the best alive. He won a Pulitzer for his Second Symphony. He won an Oscar. He's only written a couple of film scores, but he did The Red Violin in 1999 and won an Oscar. He did, if you watch the episode about Halloween scores that I did with Troy of You Gotta Hear This, he did this movie in 1980 that I played on there called Altered States. And brilliant, brilliant composer. His first symphony, which was written in response to the AIDS crisis in the 80s, is one of the most incredible pieces of contemporary music by anyone ever. I mean, it's just astonishing. And so he's a tremendous composer. So she had studied under him and then was like colleagues with Elliot Goldenthal, who had also studied with him, who went on later to write some of the greatest film scores of the 90s and early 2000s, like Interview with the Vampire, Michael Collins. He won an Oscar for Frida. He did the Final Fantasy movie. And Goldenthal, I think, is just absolutely one of the most genius composers to have ever worked in Hollywood. In fact, connecting me to Goldenthal, his big breakout score that put him on the map was Fincher's Alien 3. That was his first big movie. Although, even before that, he did the original Pet Sematary. I think I mentioned that, actually, in our one of our previous Halloween ones. But so, maybe. Goldenthal... You got to witness me fanboying for him when we met him in Poland.
It was very sweet.
His handlers tried to keep me away from him. And
I had to take a photo. Like I had to be sneaky and try to like take photos of you guys talking.
Yeah, no, I never shared that. I should share that photo. I was very glad to have that because Goldenthal to me is an absolute genius. He's also written incredible stage and concert works. In any case, I sought Denise out. And I remember she was teaching a bunch of our classmates. And there was one student who I thought was pretty talented. And one day I brought him up. I remember she said something and I said, oh, well, I saw this guy. He did it that way. And I thought that was interesting. And she goes, I don't think he's going to be successful. Oh, and I said, why? And she goes, because he's motivated by his ego. He wants to be successful. Wow. She was like, he's not passionate about music as much as he is about the idea of being told he's great. And I think that's going to hold him back. And that, I was like 19 years old, and I had never heard somebody look at success through the lens of what motivates you. And it blew my mind. And truth be told, that guy never really became that successful.
How do you know?
I still talk to him. I see him around. Like, you know, if I said his name, nobody would know who he is. And I don't mean that to sound rude, but she was kind of right. Like, I think he was frustrated for many years because he was, here's part of the problem. Here's where I can sympathize with the ego that composers develop. Most composers, composing music is a rare phenomenon. Playing music is a rare phenomenon. Like you take 100 kids in a random town, maybe 20 or 30 at most will pick up an instrument and become halfway decent at most out of 100 kids, which is a pretty decent sized percent. At best, one of those will actually say, I don't want to just learn Metallica songs or Billy Joel songs or whatever. I want to write songs or whatever. Of those, now you zoom out to 10 groups of those 100, and only a few have the one. So now we're talking about, like, say, 1,000 people. There's like 3 or 4, maybe, at most, who go, what if I wrote for orchestra? What if I tried to pursue a career in Hollywood? And so if you zoom back in, that person is surrounded by people that have never met or even imagined someone like that. They, like, when I was growing up, everybody would be like, would told me, I'm a genius. You're so, because they'd never met a composer before. So it was like, to even become a composer, you must be some kind of super genius. So what happens is all these young composers that up until they're 18 years old, they're growing up in small towns or whatever. Unless you happen to grow up in LA where you actually meet other composers, or New York or somewhere like that, mm-hmm. or London, mm-hmm. you're used to being very special. You're used to being told you're the right. only one. And so then yeah. you then go into an environment where you're surrounded by other people who've also been told that. And, yeah. and the composers become
big
very
fish, small pond.
100% mm-hmm. that. It's 100% that. And so as soon as you move to an environment where now you're the small fish in the big pond, a lot of them become very jealous. They're not. They become very neurotic. So I sympathize with that. I don't know what spared me that. I don't know why my personality was just wired differently. Because I was definitely told those same things growing up in Colorado. I was the only composer anybody ever met. So I should theoretically have fallen victim to that, but somehow I dodged it. And because I found myself excited when my peers and friends and colleagues would write good music. I found that inspiring. It made me want to be better. And I love talking to them about their process. And, you know, some of my earliest memories with Jeremy Howard Beck, a composer who I hold in the highest regard. We were classmates together at NYU. And I remember listening to his music and going, wow, he's legit. Like he's, you know, to this day, he's somebody who, you know, if he sends me new music, I know I'm going to learn something. I'm not just going to enjoy it. He's just a very deep thinker about music. We couldn't be more opposite in our process. It takes him like a year to write 5 minutes of music. And he once described me as being like a faucet where he said, you just turn it on and music just floods out. But his music is strikingly original and he's just so good. So good. He did a really powerful opera about bomb diffusers in war, like in Iraq, called The Long Walk, based on the memoir of a real guy who did it, and all about mental health and the death of like civilians and war zones, and a really, really brutal, powerful opera. He's amazing. And so anyway, so yeah, this is why I like doing You Gotta Hear This. This is why I like doing the Game Maker's Notebook, is it's basically a chance for me to sit down with a colleague and go, let's talk about you for 2 hours.
I don't know if it's going to be a ongoing thing, but you even have a video, like a yearly celebration of other composers.
Oh, like my favorites of the year.
Yeah, like a spotlight section for other composers.
Yeah, I keep a Google Doc of the scores that when I see someone sharing, like when I see a friend go, here's my new release. If I don't have a chance to listen to it, I write it down on this doc so that later I can go back and check it out if it seems like something I would like. Or could interest me, or it's someone who just consistently writes good stuff or whatever. I also have a separate list of like when I come across a score that I think this was great. This was really, really great.
How many of those videos do you have?
I think I've only done 2 of them so far.
Yeah, it's been like only 2 years.
I think I was like 20, my favorites of 2020 and my favorites of 2021, I think was.
You gotta start making this year.
The moment, like I said, I do it throughout the whole year. I have a Google Doc I just add to constantly through the whole year.
Nice. What is the name of this playlist?
Oh, on my YouTube channel, it's called mm-hmm. Nerdy Video Essays.
I was thinking of the Love Thy Comrades.
That's a separate thing.
I was thinking about that one.
Yeah, Love Thy Comrades is my sort of celebration. Like I'll do a video about a very specific score or a very specific composer. Like I did one entirely about Silvestri's score for Castaway. I did one about Desplat's score for Birth. I did a video about Ennio Morricone when he died. The first one I did was about Gustavo's score, The Last of Us, where I called the video why I would have been the wrong choice for this game.
I see. I was confused. I meant the other.
Well, they're all part of the same.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, yeah. You're just so wholesome.
Well, it's I don't know. I am genuinely inspired by what friends do. I see composers, like there's composers where I look and I go, not in a million years could I have done what they did. Like I remember when Mick Gordon gave his talk in 2016 about Doom.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean that's a GDC talk that went viral. You go on look it up on YouTube. It has like over a million views. Mm-hmm. I mean, a GDC talk at GDC is effectively a technical conference of sorts. It's not like a press event,
yeah,
or a fan event. But Mick's GDC talk went viral because it was so mind blowing, and you realize this guy isn't just good; he's got to be one of the best producers and metal composers in the history of metal. I mean, his Doom score is just impossible to overstate how good his Doom music was, and I remember going to that and thinking, I learned a lot in the last 45 minutes. Like it just, thought differently about music. Well, that's amazing. Why would I think defensively about that? Like, it's like, I felt grateful, you know, I made sure he knew how awesome I thought he was, you know, and I love that kind of stuff. I love celebrating. A part of it also is, I like the game music in particular community is still a kind of small community. And I like the idea that it feels like we're all kind of, I try to foster the feeling of like, we're all trying to cheer each other on and support each other. And there's a certain amount of camaraderie there, you know, like, cause the film music community has been around long enough and is big enough that doesn't really exist. Like there's composers that are friends, like Blake Neely and Chris Leonard's are really close friends, for example, and always supporting each other. And they're both independently very successful, but they're like, you see them together at events occasionally and things like that. Like they're obviously friends. And James Newton Howard and Hans Zimmer are clearly like good friends, that kind of thing. But it's not necessarily tight knit, you know, like I don't think of, there's not like dinner parties where you see like 16 really noteworthy composers all hanging out together or something. But that does happen in the game industry. Like you do see people, you know, like Mason Lieberman organizing, like, I'm going to get like 10 composers together just for fun because it's a cool thing, you know, or you know, like Bear called me today to congratulate me on the nomination. And I was like, aww, right back at you, buddy. There are examples of that happen. I like to keep that going. You know, I like to play my part in fostering a sense of community. It's also partly why I do the contests that I've been doing, where it might help bring new people into the community as well, where a young composer who hasn't had a shot, like, for example, I saw on Twitter, one of the people congratulating the Aliens Fire Team is this girl named Ina Almason. If you go listen to the soundtrack to Fire Team on Spotify, the last track is hers because I did a contest built around the Pathless, and I chose her as one of the winners. And so when you're playing Fire Team and there's the hangar, you hear like this kind of grungy Nine Inch Nails-ish kind of song that I wrote that's like the Marines are listening to it in the hangar. But I thought it could be cool if there's two songs that flip back and forth. The other one is I gave her the stems and I said, I want you to make a remix. And so it was her first major commercial release. You know, she was a student. She's still a student, I think. But she did a great job. She's super talented. And so I picked her as one of the winners. And like, I like the fact, I hope she brags about being involved in the game because I hope it leads to more work for her. You know what I mean? Like, it's not about me. Yeah, it's about her using it as ammo for future opportunities. So anyway, it's one of those, like, people have been good to me. I'm trying to just pay it forward at the end of the day, I think. I want to kind of keep the karma in balance because people have been very generous to me.
Yeah.
So to that end, I'll tell you my album of the day choice. One of the scores that I voted for that didn't get nominated, and it genuinely disappointed me that it wasn't nominated because I think it's my favorite score of 2022, was Horizon Forbidden West. Yoris de Man, Alexa Joe and Alexis from The Flight, like this, and Niels is the last guy's name. This is this was an excellent score. It was one of those. I was late to Horizon. I played Horizon Zero Dawn much later than its initial release, and fell totally in love with it, and fell totally in love with the score and the theme. Yoris's main theme is so good. It's so catchy. And I really loved all the wonderful work from Joe and Alexis, The Flight. And so for the sequel, it was like, okay, how do we do it again? And the score, the scope is huge. It's like 8 hours of music. It's so much music.
Holy shit.
And okay. So it was them. And then they brought in my friend Alexa to add to the group. And I remember thinking, there's no way it's going to be as good as the second one, because how can you? Like, the first one was amazing. And I was riding my bike around when it first came out earlier this year, you know, riding back and forth to the studio. And I remember just constantly being like, man, that cue, that was a great, like, I've barely played the game. I still need to really spend proper time with it. I played it a little bit on our PS5, but not much, like an hour only. But I listened to a huge chunk of the album, and every cue, I would just go, damn, like, everything about it. It's well produced. It's interesting. The way it's like this sort of savage, you know, rustic tribal music mixed with very like ultra sci-fi synth wave music. The blend of those
is how the game looks.
Yeah, and they nail it.
It's perfect.
They nail it. Mm-hmm. But it's also surprisingly tuneful and melodic. And the string, I was asking Yoris all about how they positioned the microphones. They recorded the strings at Air.
Yoris
de Man. He's a Dutch composer. You haven't met him.
Oh.
I was asking him all these questions about how he positioned the microphones and the way they recorded the strings, because it had a really special sound. It was just a really beautiful quality. And so anyway, that was one of those where I was genuinely, upset's too strong a word, but I really, really wanted them to get Grammy nominated because they deserve it. They
isn't it because dates?
No, I voted for it. It was on the list. It's like not enough other people voted for it. And I think that's a tragedy. So like I messaged them and I said, I just want you to know, I really think you should have been in there, like, you know, and I would happily, if I could somehow give them my slot, you know, I would do it in a heartbeat, because...
Oh, shut up.
I don't mean, I'm not, it's not a platitude. Like, I've had the luck. I got more than I deserve from Journey. Like, Journey was the freight train of awards. I got a lifetime's worth of acclaim, or whatever you want to call it, more than my share. I mean, the number of composers that I've met that are hugely successful that never won anything in their life. They never got nominated. You know, like my friend Sherry Chung once goes, I'm the kind of composer that will never win an award. She said that to me, and she's so successful. She scores like 5 different TV shows. She's got the new Gremlins animated show coming soon. She's really good. She's a really talented musician and composer. And I was like, that's bullshit. You shouldn't just like think of yourself as not worthy, or whatever that motivated a statement like that. Like, you're on it. You do a thing very few people could do. Especially like network shows, you know, like Kung Fu, where you got to turn, like, you got to constantly write new material. Yeah. Like, that's a skill. Mm-hmm. I don't have that skill. I couldn't do a series like that. It is a very difficult thing. And so I was like, I just remember thinking, I hope her day comes that she gets, you know, an Emmy or whatever. And she is proven wrong in a statement like that, 'cause she's absolutely deserving of it. And so that's what I mean when I say I got more than my share. I got more than a lifetime share from Journey alone. And the fact that I've been lucky enough that, you know, Abzu, Banner Saga, Assassin's Creed, these all got pretty big love. Pathless, now Fireteam. Like, I've been luckier than most. I'm luckier and it is luck. It really is that. So whereas I look at a score like Horizon and I go, this is so inspiring. Like, this gives me ideas. This, like, makes me want to get to work. That's those are my favorite scores. The ones that they're not just cool or interesting. They actually make me go,
right.
Like, I got to roll up my sleeves. This raises the bar. That's how I felt about Bear's God of War. I was like, this isn't average. This isn't even good, like above average. This is like, you know, This is going to stick around. People are going to care about this for years, with concerts or whatever. Like, it's this good. This is really good. And so I, that's my album of the day, Horizon Forbidden West.
Amazing.
A deserved Grammy nomination, in my opinion, that they should have gotten. And I, that's not to say that the scores that are there, like I said, I would happily give my spot, because I'm not saying that any of the other nominees, Bear for God of War, Steph for God of War, I mean, not God of War, Ragnarok, Assassin's Creed Ragnarok.
Yeah.
it's
all Vikings.
Chris Tin for the Old World, which was very fitting, by the way, that Chris would get nominated in there on his latest score for the same people that hired him way back in the day to write Baba Yetu, which he won a Grammy for.
That's cool.
Who am I forgetting? Who did I leave off? Richard Jakes for Guardians of the Galaxy. And I'm blanking in all my excitement. I'm suddenly.
How many are there?
Five. Should be five.
Yourself. You're just forgetting yourself.
Oh, duh. That's what it is. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, I love what they did on Horizon. That's my album of the day.
Nice. That's cool.
So anyway, what is your thoughts on the... I see you celebrating artists. You've shown me artists. You've also shared...
It's over.
What's over?
Already an hour. There's no time.
Well, no, but I just talked the whole time.
Yep.
That's not okay. That happens. No.
That's life.
Come on. No. I want to know your thoughts.
No, that's fine. Let's make it about your celebration. It's okay.
Well, then tell you what. Next time, I'm going to shut up. You're not allowed to cut this. Next time, I'll shut up. And I want you to tell me about artists that you love, that inspire you, both today, either their friends or colleagues or people you found online or whatever, and historically, like painters, you know, that we might find in a museum. I know you have some favorites as well there. And
don't worry,
I won't
about
talk
it.
About music at all.
Oh, you can talk about anything you want. I love listening to your stories.
Boosh. To quote a great artist I know, whoosh.
Oh my God. Anyway, yes, I just had some notes, but it's fine. It's no big deal.
No, tell me. I'm sure there's plenty of stuff that I said earlier you can cut.
No, that's okay. Look, it's already an hour, so it's not going to make any difference. But yeah, I guess we can have like a little last
I
guess you already said everything.
I guess in summary, I find it feels very good to celebrate my colleagues. Obviously, I don't think it reflects badly on those who don't, but I think everyone should at least try it because I think it's fun.
I think it's a waste of time. It's a waste of time to spend to think about what others do.
Well, and that's also true for sure.
Yeah, you can just channel that energy and just think about what can you do to improve whatever you want to achieve instead of observing others. But also, I wanted to point out that because of social media, we have a weird idea of people.
Mm.
And that's the only window we have.
True.
So I guess that is one of the main causes of people feeling jealousy or whatever of others' success.
Oh,
in my case, I will never share any bad news in my life. Like I'm not interested in making people tell me sorry or whatever. I'm happy to share whatever good thing is going on, and that might feel that might make others dislike me. Like I've seen it before, but you can't change what others think about you. So I guess that's their problem, and I think the only way to solve that problem is to just focus on yourself.
I agree.
Because that's like my last little note on the topic. Man, I wish I had your see, this is what I wish to have, your eloquence,
my perspicacity.
No, because I'm not trying to say the same thing differently. I'm just trying to express myself, and it's so hard for me. And I see you, and I envy you.
Anyway,
we should have a Spanish podcast, so I can rule the world.
Gracias por esta comida. Jesus Cristo. Este es todo mi idioma de español.
See, even the only quote you know in Spanish is so wholesome.
Me gusta mis compadres de música mucho.
Oh my god, yeah, you show. Yeah, that's a perfect example. That is so good to have somebody so positive in your life. People, try to get yourself a good friend like Austin. Really, it's a big thing. It's something you can do for yourself.
I really am just trying to do what I think is best, what feels best, you know, and hopefully is nice for others. So that's it. It's pretty simple at the end.
Yeah. I guess I'm just going to cut all that because
never.
I just basically
no, you cut my Spanish, my Espanol de perfecta.
I can't leave that. Don't worry.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. My apologies that I so callously dominated this episode, but gracias por Angela por su... gracias a Angela por su paciencia con me. And we'll see you next time.